My dad was a sports writer for the Des Moines Register, which in those days was one of the country's best papers, and often took me along on trips through the Midwest. Sometimes these were car trips to smaller places like Sioux City or Burlington, but at least once a summer we boarded a silvery plane, a huge event in those days, and lumbered through the summery skies up among the fleecy clouds to St. Louis or Chicago or Detroit to take in a homestand. It was a kind of working holiday for my dad. Baseball, like everything else, was part of a simpler world in those days, and I was allowed to go with him into the clubhouse and dugout and onto the field before games. I've had my hair tousled by Stan Musial. I've handed Willie Mays a ball that had skittered past him as he played catch. I have lent my binoculars to Harvey Keene, or possibly it was Billy Heft, so that he could scope some busty blonde in the upper deck. Once on a hot July afternoon, I sat in a nearly airless clubhouse under the left field grandstand at Wrigley Field beside Ernie Banks, the Cubs' great shortstop, as he autographed boxes of new white baseballs, which are, incidentally, the most pleasurably aromatic things on earth and worth spending time around anyway. Unbidden, I took it upon myself to sit beside him and pass him each new ball. This slowed the process considerably, but he gave a little smile each time and said thank you as if I had done him quite a favor. He was the nicest human being I've ever met. It was like being friends with God. I can't imagine there's ever been a more gratifying time or place to be alive than America in the 1950s. No country had ever known such prosperity. When the war ended, the United States had $26 billion worth of factories that hadn't existed before the war, $140 billion in savings and war bonds just waiting to be spent, no bomb damage, and practically no competition. All that American companies had to do was stop making tanks and battleships and start making Buicks and Frigidaires. And boy, did they. By 1951, when I came sliding down the chute, almost 90% of American families had refrigerators, and nearly three-quarters had washing machines, telephones, vacuum cleaners, and gas or electric stoves, things that most of the rest of the world could still only fantasize about. Americans owned 80% of the world's electrical goods, controlled two-thirds of the world's productive capacity, produced over 40% of its electricity, 60% of its oil, and 66% of its steel. The 5% of people on Earth who were Americans had more wealth than the other 95% combined. Remarkably, almost all this wealth was American-made. Of the 7.5 million new cars sold in America in 1954, for instance, 99.93% were made in America by Americans. We became the richest country in the world without needing the rest of the world. I don't know of anything that better conveys the happy bounty of the age than a photograph that ran in Life magazine 2 weeks before my birth. It shows the Chekalinsky family of Cleveland, Ohio, Steve, Stephanie, and two sons, Stephen and Henry, surrounded by the 2.5 tons of food that a typical blue-collar family ate in a year. Among the items they were shown with were 450 pounds of flour, 72 pounds of shortening, 56 pounds of butter, 31 chickens, 300 pounds of beef, 25 pounds of carp, 144 pounds of ham, 39 pounds of coffee, 690 pounds of potatoes, 698 quarts of milk, 131 dozen eggs, 180 loaves of bread, and 8.5 gallons of ice cream, all purchased on a budget of $25 a week. Mr. Chekalinsky made $1.96 an hour as a shipping clerk in a DuPont factory. In 1951, the average American ate 50% more than the average European. No wonder people were happy. Suddenly they were able to have things they had never dreamed of having, and they couldn't believe their luck. There was, too, a wonderful simplicity of desire. It was the last time that people would be thrilled to own a toaster or waffle iron. If you bought a major appliance, you invited the neighbors round to have a look at it. When I was about 4, my parents bought an Amana Stormore refrigerator, and for at least 6 months, it was like an honored guest in our kitchen. I'm sure they'd have drawn it up to the table at dinner if it hadn't been so heavy. When visitors dropped by unexpectedly, my father would say, "Oh, Mary, is there any iced tea in the Amana?" Then to the guests, he'd add significantly, "There usually is. It's a Stormore." "Oh, a Stormore," the male visitor would say and raise his eyebrows in the manner of someone who appreciates quality cooling. We thought about getting a Stormore ourselves, but in the end, we went for a Philco SureCool. Alice loved the Easy Glide vegetable drawer, and you can get a full quart of ice cream in the freezer box. That was a big selling point for Wendell Jr., as you can imagine. They'd all have a good laugh at that and then sit around drinking iced tea and talking appliances for an hour or so. No human beings had ever been quite this happy before.